Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Heather Brewer. She is director of NARAL Pro-Choice New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Now, this is the anniversary of Roe versus Wade. It is the 35th anniversary.
It is the 35th anniversary. It's been 35 years since the U.S. Supreme Court handed down the decision that made abortion safe and legal for all women to access in America.
Now, who was Roe and who was Wade?
Roe, the way that it works out is Roe was sort of the equivalent to a Jane Doe. Instead, it was Jane Roe. There were several cases going through at the same time, so they used variations on the name. So Roe was the woman in the case who came forward as wanting to have an abortion in protest against a law in Texas that said that she could not have an abortion. And that case was taken on by several forward-thinking pro-choice lawyers in Texas and then went all the way to the Supreme Court where the decision was handed down.
And who was Wade?
Wade, it's my understanding, it would have been the governor or the attorney general of Texas at the time for whom who would have been representing the law of the land in Texas.
So NARAL was founded in 1968. What was its, and that's 5 years before mm-hmm. Roe versus Wade, what was its role in the movement to legalize abortion?
Certainly, you know, NARAL is the political arm of the pro-choice movement. So our goal from our inception has been to use the political and legislative process to ensure that women have access to a safe, legal abortion when they need it. And that was really the role of NARAL, is working with legislatures around the country to pass legislation that would make abortion at least legal in some cases, and to just use that political and legislative process to make sure that our elected officials represent our values.
And abortion was legalized in some states before Roe versus Wade.
Yes, absolutely. There were certain states. Technically, it was legal in New Mexico prior to the Roe v. Wade decision. It was a 1969 law that was passed. We now consider that law a horrible law and in fact, are working, starting this legislative session, which we can talk about later, to repeal it because it was it allowed for abortions in certain circumstances. But the restrictions were still incredibly, incredibly strict. If a woman needed an abortion after a rape, she had to be willing to report and prosecute the rape in order to receive an abortion. If a woman needed an abortion for protection of her life or health, she would have to go before a panel of three, and let's face it, male doctors in Albuquerque and make her case. And there were a few other very obscure circumstances in which a woman could receive abortion services. Otherwise, if a physician performed that abortion, whether it would save the life of the mother, whether it was in the case of a rape, didn't matter. That physician could go to prison.
And that law is still on the books?
The law is still on the books. It's never been repealed. In 1977, Roe was used to enjoin it. So, again, a lawsuit taken up against this bad law that was on the books. The only thing that the courts used to enjoin it was Roe. So our concern as NARAL Pro-Choice New Mexico is that if the U.S. Supreme Court does anything to Roe, and this new court under Justice Roberts is decidedly more anti-choice than anything we've seen previously, if that federal Supreme Court does something with Roe, there's nothing standing between New Mexico women and a criminal abortion ban.
So what was the situation like in the United States before Roe versus Wade in terms of women actually having illegal abortions or self-induced abortions?
You know, there was a lot going on, to be perfectly honest. There is a long and unfortunate history of women who couldn't afford to get somewhere to a private doctor or private clinic where they could receive the services, trying to perform abortions on themselves and dying, ending up in the emergency room. I saw an interview with a doctor recently who's dedicated his life to pro-choice advocacy because when he was a resident in a hospital, he was standing, you know, in the emergency room, heard a woman screaming. They go to get the woman in. She had been trying to perform an abortion on herself and had punctured her uterus with a coat hanger and ended up hemorrhaging and dying. And for him, having seen that reality of what women are going through really changed him, really turned him around. What happened for some other women prior to abortion being legal is there were underground networks, many of them run by clergy, members of the clergy, that would get women to safe places where they could receive a safe abortion. And what we know, what we see in terms of statistics in countries around the world where abortion is still illegal, is that the number of abortions doesn't really change, whether it's legal or illegal. It's just, are they safe and are women surviving them?
Do we have statistics on how the incidence of death and illness from abortion changed before and after, from before and after legalization?
You know, I don't honestly have any substantial numbers on that because it would be really difficult to document exactly how many women that was the actual cause of death, because you would want, if you ended up in the ER, a lot of people were trying to cover up that that was in fact what was going on. What we do know now is that an abortion is an incredibly safe medical procedure, very low risk of complication in outpatient surgery performed.
Safer than childbirth.
Absolutely it is. And certainly there are lots of decisions to be made along the way, both of deciding to terminate a pregnancy or to continue a pregnancy. But yeah, the statistics show that an abortion procedure is safer than delivering a child.
So it seems hard to believe that the abortion rate didn't go up after Roe v. Wade, because before abortion was legalized through the Roe v. Wade decision, a lot of people, I mean, I know people who got pregnant and their parents sent them to the nuns
right,
for a year
right.
to go to school, and they had their baby and gave it up for
right.
adoption. And you know, it was only the wealthy who could fly their daughters to another country to have an abortion and so on. I thought a lot of people just had unwanted children.
Certainly there were a lot more unintended pregnancies that were carried to term. But keep in mind, there were those networks. There were doctors out there who were providing, particularly in large cities, safe abortions. Not legal, safe illegal abortions. But one thing I hear a lot from OBGYNs in the state who provide the full range of health care, who are delivering babies, doing prenatal care, and all kinds of well woman care, they say that abortion really is part of necessary women's health, that there are times when, just as a general practicing doctor who is helping women, that you're going to see someone with, you know, severe problems in a pregnancy and need to perform an abortion. And so the way they're presenting it to me is that there used to be a lot more doctors who knew how to perform an abortion, a medically necessary abortion. And so there was a lot going on that people just weren't talking about.
Now, to be statistically real about it, the vast majority of abortions are not medically necessary. They're choice. That's why it's called the pro-choice movement.
Well, you know, I think that really depends on case by case and what the circumstances are. I would say that for a woman who's in an abusive relationship and gets pregnant and needs to get out of that relationship and doesn't feel that she can do it with an infant, that there is a medically necessary a medically based choice going on there, because
her personally necessary.
Yeah, but her well-being in an abusive relationship is at stake, her child's well-being. I think there are a lot of personal and deeply emotional choices that women have to make when facing an unintended pregnancy. Not all of them are based on life-threatening circumstances, but they're certainly all based on life-altering circumstances.
Well, what are the main reasons why women choose to have an abortion?
You know, one of the providers in Albuquerque that we have a wonderful relationship with presented it to me this way. Life is never as simple as we want it to be. Everybody has their plan, their vision for how their life is going to go and if they're going to have children and when they're going to have children and how many and all that sort of good stuff. Life happens. The reason that women and their families make the decision to have an abortion is as varied as the women who go in to receive abortions. And that ranges, you know, from the unfortunate teenager, which seems to be the stereotype, up to the mother who has four kids already and just can't handle having another child and is, using contraception and is taking all of the right precautions to prevent an unintended pregnancy, but there it is.
And the career women who decide to postpone motherhood or not do motherhood.
And, you know, the other thing to think about is we know that in communities where women have control over how many and when they have children, those women do better. They do better educationally and socioeconomically, so that when they do choose to become mothers, their kids are better off. Their kids have a better education, a better life, and the communities get stronger.
Now, did the increased availability of birth control let me backtrack. When I was in college, I had a friend who was sort of half a generation older than I who was saying that when she went to college, birth control wasn't available at all. And her sister surreptitiously took her aside, who was married, and said, here's information and so on birth control, because she only had access to it because she was a married woman. You know, in a very short period of time, 10 to 15 years, it went from that to a place where, you know, a little freshman can walk into their college health center and get, you know, family planning. So did that availability of birth control reduce the rate of abortion?
Absolutely, because it reduces the rate of unintended pregnancy, period. Having access not just to contraception, but to fact-based education and information about reproduction and reproductive health care reduces the number of unintended pregnancies. It's really that simple. If you don't empower women and their partners to protect themselves from an unintended pregnancy, you're going to have them. And the more unintended pregnancies you have, the more you have women and their partners seeking abortions.
It's interesting because I was looking up the abortion rates in various countries in the world. You know what the lowest countries are?
Wait, tell me.
Holland and Belgium. Mm. The most liberal, I mean, you know, prostitution is legal, and they have the lowest abortion rate at Holland in the whole world.
Yeah. And my assumption would be, I don't do activism in Holland, but my assumption would be that there is very easy and available access to contraception. Northern European countries as well tend to have much lower birth rates than other countries for a variety of different reasons. And part of that is access to consistent, long-term, effective contraception.
Do you find that women are having abortions when they find out, for example, that they have a child, that they're pregnant with a child who's going to have Down syndrome?
You know what? Every woman makes her own decision. We don't provide, at NARAL, we don't provide abortion services. We provide referrals to abortion providers. And, you know, I did have a conversation with a woman the other day who has just found out that her fetus has a severe anomaly and that it will not likely survive at all outside the womb. And she and her partner are faced with a very difficult decision of, do we carry the pregnancy to term or do we end the pregnancy now? And those are the kinds of decisions where we really, really believe strongly that medical privacy and the rights of women and their families to make their own medical decisions are critical. It's not a place any of us wants to be. It's not a place any of us expects to be. But if we are there, women and their families need to know that we trust them to make the decisions that are best for them and for their families.
Are most decisions done during the first trimester, the first 3 months of pregnancy?
Yes, the overwhelming vast majority of abortions are performed in the first trimester.
And when and why are they ever done later than that?
You know, there's this great myth, you know, that the anti-choice community has out there, that there are all these abortions being performed in the third trimester and it's terrible and it's all of this. The third trimester abortions are incredibly rare, incredibly. It's a percent of abortions are performed later on in the pregnancy, and they're performed when the health of life of the mother is in serious jeopardy. When you've got a woman who was diagnosed with aggressive breast cancer during her pregnancy, needs to undergo immediate chemotherapy in order to save her own life and help her raise her other children, and she and her partner have to make this decision, what are we going to do? Or it's someone like the woman I was just talking about who finds out late in her pregnancy that there is a severe problem with her fetus and it will not survive outside the womb. Those are decisions that those women have to make on their own. Some women choose to delay treatment on themselves until after the baby is born. Some women choose to give birth to a stillborn fetus rather than having an abortion performed during the pregnancy. It's all about choice. And you might choose one thing, I might choose another, but what we just really have to keep in mind is we can't be dictating to women what the right medical decisions are for them.
What has been the effect of the morning after pill on the rate of abortion?
You know, the morning after pill is a wonderful, wonderful tool. It's a high-dose contraceptive pill that can be taken within 72 to 120 hours of having unprotected sex or if there's a contraceptive failure. And it will prevent ovulation and therefore prevent a pregnancy. And it's a wonderful tool. It's great that we have it. It took a long time to get FDA approval. One of the things that we're finding is not enough people know about it. And when the time comes, when the condom breaks or something happens, then, and it would be the appropriate time to use emergency contraception, they don't have it, they don't know where to get it, and they don't think about it. So one of the things we've been doing at NARAL and a lot of other organizations around the state have been doing is working on awareness. Emergency contraception, brand name Plan B, is available over the counter without a prescription for all women over age 18. You just go into your pharmacy, ask your pharmacist for it, and you stick it in your medicine cabinet. It's we sort of equate it to a fire extinguisher. You keep one in your kitchen just in case you ever have a fire. We hope you never have to use it, but if you do, it's there. Same thing with emergency contraception. You take all the precautions you can in advance. We hope you never have to use your emergency contraception, but if there's a problem, if you do need it, it's there.
What about RU486? Is that considered an alternative to abortion, or is it considered abortion?
It's an abortion. It's a what's called a medication abortion, and it's administered by a doctor. A woman is under supervision, but it's a procedure that is used only in very, very early pregnancies. So it is an option that is available to women.
Meaning the first month or something?
I forget what the exact date is where you have to be so many weeks pregnant before they can actually do a sonogram to confirm a pregnancy and then perform an abortion. So there's a certain number of weeks at least you have to be pregnant, and then after a certain number of weeks, the RU486, the medication abortion, is not useful.
Now, we're here in New Mexico where we have, I think, a higher than the national average rate of teenage pregnancy and certainly much higher than the national average poverty rate. What is NARAL doing to educate teenagers and the people who teach teenagers?
Well, one of the biggest things that has happened in the past couple of weeks, actually, to make a huge impact on that, and NARAL was part of a coalition working to make this happen, is the Secretary of Health here in New Mexico declined federal abstinence-only education funding, meaning that schools in New Mexico no longer will be hamstrung and forced to teach abstinence-only education. And so what students will be receiving in schools is comprehensive, fact-based, complete sexuality education that will help teenagers be informed if they are going to become sexually active. Here's how to stay safe, not just from unintended pregnancies, but from STDs and from the other risks that do come along with sexual activity. And what I was saying earlier in terms of the impact that women not having control over their fertility has on the socioeconomic status of a community is really meaningful here as well. When you have a girl who gets pregnant at 16, she's much, much, much less likely to go to college and even less likely to have graduated from high school in the first place. So you're looking at someone whose earning capacity has just been dramatically cut down, whose education level has just been dramatically cut down, and whose children subsequently will face the same barriers. So here in New Mexico, I think the greatest victory that we've had is getting that comprehensive sexuality education in there, and that's something that we at NARAL do a lot of outreach around, is ensuring that the education is comprehensive and fact-based for our teens.
Up until New Mexico declined this abstinence-only education, what was the education in our schools looking like? I mean, was it all over the state? You couldn't teach what?
It was fairly ad hoc, to be perfectly honest. If a district accepted the federal funds as the state accepted them, then that district was hamstrung in what they could teach. And many districts did. They needed the money, and therefore they went in and taught abstinence-only education.
How long was that going on?
Bush administration.
Yeah, so almost 7 years.
Yeah. And you're looking at, you know,
it would be so interesting to study how many teenagers got pregnant as a result of not having had proper sex education.
Well, to be perfectly honest, there was a great study that was released a few months before. Not only Secretary Vigil declined the money here, but as the momentum really started nationally to say this is not working. And the study showed it does not, you know, abstinence only does not stop teens from having sex. It doesn't stop them from getting pregnant. We should all encourage teens and everyone we know to have sex within the context of healthy, supportive relationships where they're protecting themselves and their partners. But ignoring the problem and insisting that abstinence is the only way that you could possibly live your life is not practical, and it was doing a great injustice to our kids.
Let's talk for a moment about what you call the anti-choice and what they call the pro-life movement.
Mm-hmm.
What is the motivation for this movement, and what are their tactics?
For the anti-choice community?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd have to ask one of them. Because, you know, from my perspective, their agenda is preventing women from making the decisions that are best for women, that their movement doesn't trust women, and the pro-choice movement trusts women to make the decisions that are best for them.
One of the things that I know that they've done is having, even though they can't pass, because of Roe versus Wade, laws banning abortion, they'll pass laws saying that there's a waiting period, and this delay sometimes leads to women carrying pregnancies to term that they had intended not to.
Absolutely. And the thing that really I find disconcerting about those initiatives in particular is that they disproportionately impact low-income women. If you're a woman who's working three jobs and doesn't have paid leave and doesn't have all of those good things, it's impossible for you to go to a doctor's appointment in New Mexico. You would have to travel a great distance to get to one of our providers in Albuquerque or Santa Fe. They're the only two locations. And you'd have to take a day off of work, go in for your initial consultation, 24-hour waiting period, come back. That's another day off of work, all the travel, the money that goes into it. If you have to stay overnight, you've got to pay for hotels. It's a great injustice for low-income women. Women with means will be able to take the time off. They will be able to afford the hurdles that are being put in their way. So I think that these...
Which has always been the case.
Exactly. It really has. And so I think that the anti-choice argument that this is really protecting women and helping them, it is really false. And it really is used to cover up the fact that their agenda not only hurts women, but disproportionately hurts low-income women, many of whom really benefit the most from receiving these services.
I think because that movement is so passionately felt, and the people who, you know, who really believe that no woman should ever have an abortion or almost never have an abortion, it seems to boil down to fundamentally different ideas about what the role of a woman is.
I would agree.
And what the place of sex is.
I would agree. I would argue that the anti-choice agenda is fundamentally an anti-woman agenda. And we saw that, I think, particularly in the last legislative session, and I'm hoping we won't see it again, but, you know, that's the way these things go, when we had no fewer than three bills that proposed penalties for women who delivered babies under certain circumstances. There was a criminal penalty. There was forced sterilization. There's forced contraception for any woman who delivered a child that had any indication that there may have been drugs or alcohol used during the pregnancy.
Oh, boy.
And when you think about it, there are women in our state who may be using drugs or alcohol during a pregnancy. But there are also ways of addressing that are much more positive and much more about helping the woman and helping her child and less about punishing behavior we don't like and punishing women that we don't like the choices that they're making.
And I would think that the most effective way of preventing those things would be just massive education.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we had a case in front of the New Mexico Supreme Court last spring where a woman in Hobbs, New Mexico, delivered a baby with traces of cocaine in the baby's system. She was not immediately arrested. There was some subsequent conversations, and then she was arrested, put in jail, under the child abuse statutes in this state. This was a woman who, it is documented that during her pregnancy, came into a public health clinic, said, I have a problem, I need help, was given a pamphlet and sent home. And then in the end is thrown in jail for this behavior. I'm not saying it's a good choice. I'm not saying this is what we want women to do. But when you've got a state with a high level of alcoholism and with many communities that have disproportionate substance abuse issues going on, it needs to be about treating women, not punishing women and punishing behaviors that we don't like.
That leads to a question, which is, what about public funding for abortion or any funding for abortion? I mean, we live in a poor state. Here we are in New Mexico. What if a woman wants an abortion and can't afford it?
She can get one through Medicaid.
Is that right?
In New Mexico, NARAL brought a lawsuit against the state of New Mexico under the Johnson administration, saying that the Equal Rights Amendment in our state constitution should provide equal coverage for women for reproductive health care under Medicaid as it does for men under Medicaid. And in a very important landmark decision on the New Mexico Supreme Court, it was decided that, in fact, the ERA does provide for that. And so New Mexico is one of the few states in the country that provides funding for low-income women to receive abortion services.
Do poor women still get fewer abortions? I mean, obviously, raising a child costs a lot of money, too.
No, absolutely. I mean, there are pros and cons on either side, and women have to make those choices. There are obviously services available in the state that help women with young children to help provide nutrition and education and child care and those sorts of things. And those are wonderful programs for the women who choose to make that choice. But for women who choose to end a pregnancy, they have that option available to them as well, and they can receive state funding through Medicaid.
Now, what about herbal forms of abortion? I was traveling in Peru once, and an Inca told me about this plant that, in fact, happens to grow as a weed in my yard in New Mexico, which they make a tea out of, and apparently Inca women were using that from time immemorial.
You know, it's interesting. We've began doing some strategic outreach in the Native American community here in New Mexico, talking about contraception, and particularly emergency contraception, which is a great tool to have around in rural communities where your access to reproductive health care is restricted by geography. And that's what we've heard is that, you know, abortion is not something that's necessarily talked about, but your grandmother always knew the right herbs to mix together or something. You know, these stories from, you know, back in the day, you know, that there are cultural traditions around this problem. This is not some problem that the United States has invented in the past 30 years. It's not. You know, in any society throughout time, there have been circumstances and reasons why a woman felt that she could not be pregnant. And women have banded together and found solutions for that for centuries.
Now, in this country, I've heard of people who, especially girls, who were too scared to admit that they were pregnant or seek an abortion, trying to find home remedies and herbal remedies. And I would think that there would be maybe a little bit of danger in that if they don't know how to dose themselves.
Well, what I've heard more of are chemical home remedies that certainly when abortions were illegal or a woman couldn't get access to them, I've heard about douching with Lysol, ammonia, various things that women did to hopefully, and I've heard that it was used to try to prevent a pregnancy after unprotected sex and also used to try and terminate a pregnancy if one were present. So, yeah, there are a lot of extreme lengths that scared women will go to. And women don't deserve to be scared. They deserve to be able to make their own choices about what's best for them and their families.
I think it's hard sometimes if you're an adult woman and have been an adult for some time to remember how scary this stuff was when you were 15 and even 20.
Yeah. You know, there's a really tragic story out of Indiana that highlights that very well. There's a girl named Becky Bell who is a teenager. Superstar, cheerleader, beautiful girl, all-American girl kind of thing, got pregnant and was just scared. She didn't want to disappoint her parents. She didn't know what her family would say. She just didn't know, and she was scared. Indiana has a parental notification law. She went to get a back alley abortion. She died. And this was when I was a teenager. This is not back in the 1940s or 1930s or something like that. This is in the late 80s, early 90s, where you have a teenage girl with all the world in front of her, who is so scared and so devastated by a mistake that it cost her life. And her parents, my sincere appreciation and gratitude for them for having turned that experience on their part into a real launching off point for advocacy. And they've been very outspoken advocates against parental notification laws.
And have parental notification laws been overturned anywhere?
Well, we in New Mexico still don't have one. So it is still possible to beat them down and to prevent them from happening. Because there really is, there's the danger, of course, of the girl who just is scared, who's just a normal teenager and is just so scared they can't do it. And really, 80%, I believe, or 78 or 80% of girls who get pregnant involve their parents. You know, it's like anything else. When you're a kid, your parents are your go-to people. It's that other fraction of teens who get pregnant who can't, who feel for whatever reason they can't talk to their parents. And there are situations where the parent is the reason they're pregnant, where there was violence in the home, sexual violence in the home that caused the pregnancy, or there is...
You mean incest?
Incest, yeah. In the home. Or there's physical abuse in the home and the girl's scared she's going to get beaten by her parent if she tells them about that. Those are the kids that we have to look out for. Those are the kids that we have to understand will never be able to go to their parents. We can't legislate healthy families. We can only help women be healthy.
There's a wonderful novel written by a woman named called Choices.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
By
Kate Buckley.
Kate
here
Buckley,
in Santa Fe.
whom we had on the air. And it's a marvelous book about a teenage girl who gets pregnant, and one of her parents is part of the anti-abortion movement, and you know, it's a great dramatization of what families go through when this actually comes into their own home.
Yeah, no, it's a great way to really explain what it's like, what really happens to families. And it's interesting because, you know, part of the premise of the book is that the girl's mother is anti-choice and that she's actually involved in the anti-choice movement. And I've heard several stories from providers where they've come in to meet with a patient and found that it is a mother who's been out, or a father who's been outside their clinic protesting, who's now there with his or her teenage daughter. And, you know, this is different. This is, you know, this is my family. It's different.
Wow.
I know, you know, and again, it just goes back to the whole thing. It's really easy to sit and pass judgment on what other people do, but we just have to keep in mind that our lives are never as simple as we want them to be. It's never black and white. It's all kinds of shades of gray. And when you're faced with certain choices, you don't know what you're going to do until you're in that situation. And we just need to make sure that whatever choice you make that's right for you and your family, you're able to access that choice.
Well, I think it also gets into a question that we've discussed in other contexts on this program, which is, are medical decisions made by doctors and patients, or are they made by courts?
Absolutely. And we believe very strongly that politicians, they're wonderful people, but they're not necessarily physicians. And we don't need, there's no room in an examination area for a patient, her doctor, and the justices on the Supreme Court. We really just need to let doctors make the best, give their patients the best advice and let their patients make the best decisions. We need to trust women.
Would you like to comment on the state of abortion laws around the world? I mean, China is a really tough case where, because there's a one-child policy, all these women are aborting female fetuses to the point where there are some towns where you have a huge ratio of males to females.
Yeah. You know, I'll be really honest. My work focuses very much domestically and really specifically in New Mexico. And certainly abortion around the world is really a unique and very important issue, even here in New Mexico, because of the rate of immigration into this country. And so women who are coming into this state and this country from Central America, South America, with different understandings about what their rights are, that's a place where there's a lot of education, a lot of work to be done to make sure that immigrant women get access to reproductive health care here, and that we really take into consideration their unique cultural perspectives on reproductive health care based on their countries of origin.
So let's say you were working with Latin American immigrants in Albuquerque. Besides providing Spanish language services, how do you present service? prevent the information differently based on cultural differences?
You know, one of the things that we found in a previous program that we were conducting out of NARAL, which was really actively going into communities and working with immigrants around the issues of reproductive health care, was that there's a fundamental level of sex education that needed to be done. So in addition, to having bilingual material or Spanish language material, there's a need to do just fundamental sex ed. This is how you get pregnant. This is how you prevent a pregnancy. These are what your options are. This is blah, 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 blah. Because when you look at a lot of the immigration that we're seeing now, it's among people who are here to help advance themselves and their families economically. And so they're not necessarily coming from the best educational backgrounds, and they may not have received that information initially. And that was an important part of the work that was being done, was not getting people registered to vote against anti-choice politicians, but making sure that women know, this is how you get pregnant, this is when you get pregnant, this is why, you know, and just getting that basic information out there.
So you have an event coming up.
We do. Every year, we actually have two events coming up. Every year on the anniversary of Roe, we have a Champion of Choice dinner, and it's at La Fonda here in Santa Fe. And this year for the 35th anniversary, we're honoring Generations of Choice. So we'll be honoring the life and work of Justice Pamela Mintzmyer, who passed away last year, but who is the justice who wrote the Supreme Court decision I was talking about that allowed for low-income women to receive abortion services through Medicaid. Attorney General Gary King will be there to give us an update on the state of choice in New Mexico. And then we always present an award for a young activist who's working on the choice issue. And this year we're thrilled to be presenting that award actually to an organization, Young Women United, which is a great organization helping women of color get active in their community. And they've done a tremendous amount of positive work around preventing abstinence only from being taught in their schools. And these are amazing girls. They're 13, 14, 15, 16, getting involved and learning what needs to be done. So we're really excited about having them. And then on the day before our dinner, so on January 22nd, the actual 35th anniversary of Roe, we'll have our annual lobby day and rally. So at noon outside the Capitol, on the east front of the Capitol, we'll have our big anniversary rally, and we'll be talking about our legislative initiative to repeal the 1969 criminal abortion ban. And Representative Mimi Stewart will be introducing that, and she'll be on hand to help talk about the legislation. And just really looking at the fact that 35 years later, there are still fundamental ways in which we need to keep fighting for this right.
How does the pro-choice movement fit into the overall women's movement?
Personally, I don't think you can separate one from the other, because the women's movement is about empowering women to make the choices and live their lives in the way that they choose, however that looks, whatever that means to individual women. And it's not possible to present women with a full range of choices and lifestyle options and education options without making sure that they have control over their fertility.
I think also, we just started to touch on this before, but just the simple fact of women's sexuality and sexuality in general being a positive thing, and also being a thing that you even acknowledge that people are doing all the time.
Right.
And if
right.
they're not, they wish they were.
Right. Well, I think that's also part of the hypocrisy of the anti-choice movement, is that somehow they can get teens, to just not have sex, just not do it, not think about it, not want to do it, blah, blah, blah. And it's sort of like you were saying, it's been a while since we were teens, but I remember what that was like. And to think that it's even possible to tell a 16-year-old not to think about sex until you're 25, or, getting married at 30 or whatever it is, it's really unrealistic.
You're thinking about it is just going to happen.
Whether
you do it or not, I'm one of those people who started quite late. But it wasn't because I didn't think about it constantly.
I think it does. The whole conversation that we're having about whether abortion should be safe and legal and available to women in the country, I think is an outgrowth of our attitudes towards sexual activity. Sexual activity leads to pregnancy. And it's just the way it is. It's the way it was designed to be, or the way it ended up being over time. And it's incumbent upon us to be comfortable with every aspect of that, that not only are there many, many beautiful, wonderful, wanted pregnancies, but there are also the consequence of sex is, unfortunately, unintended pregnancies, and in some circumstances, so unwanted that they do need to be ended.
I think if you are in favor of birth control, you have to acknowledge that birth control doesn't always work and that abortion is part of the larger, and you know, we hope to have it be as happen as little as possible, ideally, but part of the overall strategy that's involved with contraception, if you believe in contraception in the first place.
Absolutely. And what's fascinating to me is that there are so many of these folks who are out there working against a woman's right to choose a safe legal abortion who don't support access to contraception, who don't support it. And it just seems crazy to me that you disagree with us on abortion. Can't we work together on prevention? Can't we find some common ground and reduce the number of unintended pregnancies? And everybody wins if we reduce the number of surgical procedures that women have to undergo. And it's amazing to me that there is a backlash against contraception. And what's more amazing to me is that I hear that sometimes from men, that they, you know, don't believe in contraception. And then you sort of look at their family where they have two children 2 years apart. Well, someone in your household believed in contraception. You know, there's that public presentation of what you think is right and your attitudes. But the reality is, in a lot of these folks' households as well, they're not walking that walk.
I think we're also coming into a time, and I say this partly because of having read this book recently called The World Without Us, which looked at the environmental consequences of what would happen if all human beings disappeared at once, and, you know, the nuclear power plants and the plastic bags and the, you know, all this stuff. But one of the things that was really a very major conclusion of this is that the environmental, the ability of the planet to sustain a growing number of people, I mean, it won't. You know, there are limits. We've already crossed some of those limits. We have 10% of the fish in the ocean that we had 50 years ago. I mean, 90% of the fish are gone. It seems that if you look at this, the situation of the globe at a world scale, family planning is as necessary an environmental action.
Absolutely.
As, you know, turning off your incandescent light bulbs or whatever, you know, driving a good car that doesn't produce a lot of toxins.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot to be said for that argument. And certainly, you know, we heard it a lot in the 70s with the zero population growth movement. But definitely where population is out of control, you don't have, you know, as we've been saying, you don't have healthy communities. You don't have women who are functioning economic members, participating members of their communities. And you end up with just the compounding factors of no one's taking care of the environment. No one has the education to do certain things. And it really is a compounding factor. And that responsible family planning is a key tool to ensuring that, you know, the environment is safe, that there's enough food for people to eat, and that families truly are taken care of, as is our world.
We've got just a couple of minutes left. Tell people how they can get involved, how they can come to the upcoming NARAL Pro-Choice New Mexico events if they would like to, and any other information you'd like to give.
Absolutely. And we would love to have as many people as possible come out this year, particularly in the wake of the clinic violence that we've seen recently in Albuquerque. We had three attacks on clinics in Albuquerque, two firebombs, one where the windows were knocked out. And so we really want to make a powerful show that women's rights are important to New Mexicans. New Mexico is a pro-choice state. We value access to health care. So anyone who is interested in joining us for the rally on January 22nd or for the dinner on January 23rd, please go to our website. It's prochoicenm.org or prochoicenewmexico.org. Or you can call us at our office in Albuquerque. It's 243-4443, and we'd be happy to get you information and get you involved. This is a critical first year for us of a legislative program in which we are committed to overturning that criminal abortion ban and making sure that no matter what the U.S. Supreme Court does, no matter what happens out there in Washington, that here in New Mexico, women will have access to the reproductive health care they need.
Was anybody prosecuted for the attacks on the clinics in Albuquerque?
There have been two arrests for the first attack, which was on Dr. Boyd's clinic in Albuquerque, but nothing yet in the Planned Parenthood case. So we will see. And certainly if anybody has any information, has heard anything, saw anything, please report it to the authorities. The FBI is aggressively investigating. We're very pleased. But that's really where we are right now. We need to focus on figuring out what happened and why, making sure it doesn't happen again.
Heather Brewer is the director of NARAL Pro-Choice New Mexico. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. I sure appreciate it.
And the phone number of NARAL Pro-Choice New Mexico is in Albuquerque, 505-243-4443. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by the Santa Fe Farmers Market. The market now meets indoors at a new location, 519 Cerrillos Road, just north of Paseo de Peralta, on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. The indoor market features meats, cheeses, apples, honey, nuts, greens, tomatoes, root vegetables, and other veggies, as well as baked goods, juices, jams, condiments, dried chile, and more. For more information, call 983-4098 or visit santafefarmersmarket.com.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Locals Care. Locals Care community cards reward you for shopping and dining at over 100 locally owned businesses. You can support a Santa Fe nonprofit and earn rewards for yourself at any Locals Care business. Find program information and a current list of participating businesses and nonprofits at locals-care.com. Offered in cooperation with the Santa Fe Alliance and sponsored by Los Alamos National Bank, the New Mexican, and the City of Santa Fe.
Come hear Pulitzer Prize-winning N. Scott Mamadé and Lucy Tapajanzo this Friday evening at 7 p.m. at the James A. Little Theater. Through his novels, poems, plays, books of folk tales, memoirs, essays, and speeches, Mamadé has won international respect. Lucy Tapajanzo is well known for her collections of stories and poems, which have been met with much critical attention and acclaim. Join them this Friday, January 18th at the James A. Little Theater. For tickets, call the Lensic at 988-1234. All profits will benefit a summer program at Monte del Sol Charter School. Thank you.